Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Health Care. It is March 7th, and we have a quorum, so we're going to we're going to whip right through these. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 558.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 558 to the floor with due pass recommendation and request that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Cruz moves that Senate Bill 558 move to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Chair of the subcommittee that's going to get it. Thanks you very much, Madam
Chair. Okay.
I'm one of the sponsors of the bill. I understand that. There may be some budget issues. This may be a very complicated thing before the end of the day.
Senator, I always admire your power of understatement.
It is promoting children's health, and you know that's the right thing to do. It's an economic value to the state. Investing in the health of our kids now is going to develop a skilled workforce in the future, and I'm very excited about this bill. Is there any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Meyer?
Excused.
Senator Knoll?
Excused.
Senator Steiner-Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monsanto?
Aye. Motion carries, and it is headed down to Ways and Means, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 558. And I'm going to open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2328. Oliver?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2328, brought to you by the State Board of Psychological Examiners. The measure is fairly straightforward. The bill simply renames the State Board of Psychologist Examiner to the Oregon Board of Psychology. The measure has a minimal physical impact, no revenue impact. Impact statements are on OLIS.
Good afternoon, Chair Senator Moniz Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is Charles Hill. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Psychologist Examiners. What you have before you is a fairly complicated bill. Basically, the board would wish to name the State Board of Psychologist Examiners to the Oregon Board of Psychology. And a little bit of background, the State Board of Psychologist Examiners, or the board, has found that the agency name is cumbersome and reflects an antiquated notion of the board's function. It may also confuse the public. The board no longer administers the national exam and has transitioned from an oral to a written jurisprudence exam. The mission of the board is much broader than examination. It is to promote, preserve, and protect the public health and welfare by ensuring the ethical and legal practice of psychology. Like the Board of Medical Examiners did in 2007 through State or Senate Bill 147, they changed their name to the Medical Board. The board is just proposing to change its name to the Oregon Board of Psychology.
And there's no opposition to the bill, I assume?
No, ma'am.
Are there any questions? I will close a public hearing on House Bill 2328, and I will open a work session on House Bill 2328.
I'm going to try and move House Bill 2328 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2328 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Meyer.
Excused.
Senator Knoll?
Excused.
Senator Steiner-Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monsanto?
Aye. Motion carries. And would you like to carry this bill?
Thank you, committee.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Cruz will carry the bill, and I will close the work session. Did I open a work session?
Yes, you did.
Yes. On 2328. And we're waiting for Senator Hansel. I told him to be here at 1:15, but we went so fast that you're going to go get him. Yes, okay.
Be right back. What you do?
So let's be at ease. We'll be in recess or at ease.
For a minute.
For just a minute. Okay, we are going to resume the Committee on Health Care, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 367. Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator for District 29, North Central and Eastern Oregon. Senate Bill 367 comes to you based on a request I received from Brian Brandstetter and Jeff Kaufman, two workers at Eastern Oregon Correctional Institute, one of two prisons I have in my district. They explained to me, and will explain to you soon, as both have traveled from Pendleton to be here to testify before you today, of the importance of this bill. Inmates with unacceptable behavior can and have exposed employees to bodily fluids. This puts a correction officer at significant risk as to whether or not they've been exposed to a communicable disease that needs to be treated by professional health care workers. When guards are exposed to inmates' bodily fluids, such as spit or urine, they must seek medical attention. Currently, they will be given a cocktail of medicines to address any potential exposure, whether or not they've actually been exposed. This treatment often causes the employees to become ill and sometimes up to a month of sick time off before they're well enough to return to work. Senate Bill 367 attempts to address this problem. We were approached by the Department of Corrections recently with a question regarding the bill. When we went over the bill with them, we noticed the bill was not as specific to our intent as it should have been. Thus, the Dash 1 amendments were drafted. I absolutely want the Dash 1 amendments to be adopted as a part of this bill. Senate Bill 367-1 would allow a health care provider to disclose health information of an inmate who is under the authority of the Department of Corrections to the corrections officer's doctor upon request. This information can only be used if the exposure is viewed to be a substantial and if the inmate who did the exposing has tested positive for HIV, hepatitis B or C, or any other communicable diseases transmitted through bodily fluids. It should be noted, only the minimum information necessary is to be given to the employee's doctor. This way, the doctor can begin the medical treatment that is needed timely. Senate Bill 367-1 creates a quick response to protecting our corrections officers who have been exposed. Otherwise, the correction officer has to be treated for all the potential serious, even life-threatening diseases. If there are no diseases present, then no treatment is needed. Our corrections officers serve all of us in a sometimes very hostile environment, with the risk of harm always present. Senate Bill 361-1 will give officers and their families peace of mind to know if they have been exposed and an opportunity for appropriate treatment to begin as soon as possible. Mr. Brandstetter and Mr. Kaufman can give specific examples of what people experience who take the cocktail, as well as answer any specific questions and the need for this kind of protection that you might have. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Senator Hansel, thank you so much for bringing this bill. I think it's a great idea. I have two questions for you. The first is, how will this protect our corrections officers, our sheriff's deputies at our county jails? Because many people who are adjudicated end up spending their sentence or pre-adjudication are in the county jails. And I would believe that those deputies deserve just as much protection as our corrections officers in our state penitentiaries.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Member Steiner Hayward, I absolutely agree with you. I think that would be a Dash 2 amendment to this bill.
if you wouldn't mind, I would work with committee to add that in, Senator.
Yes, absolutely. Because we were focused on the state penitentiary, and the need that was there, and the you know, that was a focus here. But yeah, I think a correction officer in any facility, jail, prison, maybe even I don't know what else, maybe state hospital.
I would argue, but, if I might, Madam Chair, that actually we probably ought to apply it to law enforcement, because one could imagine that a public safety officer in the course of an arrest could sustain a substantial exposure that might qualify under this definition. So
if it's worded right, I would certainly be supportive of that.
Thank you.
I sometimes happens here I don't want this to be lost because we became too big. And
I would agree with you. I'll talk to some folks in law enforcement, if I might, but certainly for the county jails, I think the deputies who are serving there deserve analogous protection.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Senator. Yeah. Oh, and Madam Chair, one quick question, if I could. Mm-hmm. If I read the DASH 1 correctly, the only time that disclosure will happen is if there's actually those diseases present. Does that mean that the prison can't tell the officer's physician that the inmate does not have the diseases?
No, they can.
They can?
Absolutely. What my understanding is what happens now, because you can get that information, mm-hmm. but it's lengthy and it's time consuming, and sometimes you have to go to a court to do that. But in the meantime, if they have been exposed, it begins to incubate.
Right.
And by the time they get permission to find out what to treat, the disease may have already taken effect. So the idea was it's timeliness.
Right.
And only between medical professionals, they need to know, okay, do I need to treat for anything? And if so, what? And then proper treatment, so they don't have to be treated for diseases that aren't even present. And you know, the worst thing that can happen is that everything is fine, but you don't know that, and so they go through this they get sick, they lose time in the prison, and it's all unnecessary because there wasn't anything present, but you don't know that.
Right. Thank you very much, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay. I know you're going to stay for the next one, too, but let's call up then Jeff Kaufman. Is it Brian Brancett and Roger Waite?
Good afternoon, Chair Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Kaufman. I'm president of Local 3361, which is the EOCI. This came about probably a couple years ago. As president, I'm notified anytime a staff member's injured, and I go up to the hospital, or someone from my staff or keyboard goes to the hospital to be with them, tell them what's involved and stuff. And actually, ER physician asked me, why can't we get this information? He's called DOC. They won't release the information. So without knowing what the inmate may or may not have, we don't know what to treat, so we have to treat for the most extreme. So it only made sense to me that we advanced this to get my staff members protected. Just an example, last year in 2016 at my prison, there were 171 fights. And not all of them had infections, but even a percentage makes a big difference. And let's do Mr. Brandstetter cover what happened last night.
Chairman Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. Last night at our institution, there was a fight that ensued up on the Echo 3 housing unit. And during that fight...
Oh, for the record, you need to state your name.
Brian Brandstetter. Sorry about that, ma'am. Anyway, last night during that fight that ensued up there, there was an individual that had been taken and classified as a potential risk. not for anything other than towards staff assaults and other things. During that altercation, there were a lot of body fluids that were exposed to two staff members, and one of them was injured, and one of them was covered, and he also had a cut. Both the staff members were taken actually to the hospital last night, and at 1 o'clock, the doctor hadn't even seen them yet. And at that particular time, because they both had been exposed to body fluids, both of them are in the plans or in the makings of taking that cocktail. This is only one instance that happened, and that was yesterday. This happens from time to time. In my 28 years with the Department of Corrections, I can't tell you how many times I've seen staff exposed to body fluids. And the people that have taken this cocktail get very sick. Some of them, actually, because it basically cleans out your system, restarts it, and causes other things to happen, you're very ill for upwards of 30 days or longer. And the system ends up taking about 6 months to actually work through the whole process. But because of those things, that's why this legislation will be helpful, because if you don't need to take it and you don't need to open up your system, because if you're taking a lot of things, much as like what chemo is to restart your system, you also expose yourself and other things. You're not only exposing yourself to it, it's what your family goes through that are there. And this will at least help alleviate or at least give the doctor there the timely information in order to be able to treat the members that we represent that are there. And I appreciate Senator Hayward's look at theirs. This was looked at from our point of view to try to cover our members. This in itself could potentially help a whole lot of people that are working within the public safety. It's not just the correctional officers that have to do it. We have nurses that respond to the units to take care of the staff and the inmates that are there. It covers, I would hope, all the people who work with inside, whether it's a state prison or a county correctional facility or a peace officer, because this is a piece where people do not know what they get exposed to at the time. And it's timely information that is hugely important. And because currently when you take, if we have to go through the other process, we actually have to ask through the court system to get that information released. And we could request today, but by the time it gets through the court and then a judge orders it, it takes a while for that to happen. And by that time, you could end up with the disease and then having to treat the disease besides with the cocktail and being sick. So anything that we can do to help, if you have any questions, please feel free to ask.
Just, I'm assuming because this is still information inside the system, it's, there's no violation of HIPAA in this. Would that be correct?
It shouldn't be because it's still medical to medical.
Right, and that's why we asked that it be put the way that it was,
right.
So that it went from the medical professionals at the institution to the medical professional that treats you.
Chair Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, my name is Roger Ware. Thank you for, and the rest of the committee, thank you for allowing us to come and talk on this today. I am not only a 17-year correctional officer, I've since left DOC and now I work for AFSCME, where I represent the fine men and women that protect us inside of our institutions. I came to talk to you today a little bit and give you a couple different scenarios that goes on when a body fluid exposure takes place. One scenario I wanted to pass on to you is I had about a year and a half ago, one of my transport officers that had an inmate at a hospital. They were conducting a medical test inside the hospital. Inmate got upset with the medical staff inside the hospital and decided that he was going to express that by ripping the IV out of his artery and thereby causing both of the transport staff to be very heavily coated in his blood. That staff then had to go back home, change his clothes, take a shower, and go to his doctor. His doctor then had to run the first series of IV draws at that day to find out what his baseline was. Within 30 days, he had to come back in and have another series of IVs drawn so he could find out if there was any type of change in that baseline. During that whole time period, he doesn't know if he has any type of infection. He doesn't know if the inmate had an infection, whether he should be worried. He has to distance himself from his family, from his spouse and his kids, because if he is now infected, he can be passing that on to his family. And then he had to make a determination on whether to take this cocktail that we're talking about. And that cocktail, not only is it very expensive for the state to administer, that we could be offsetting by having that information there. It's also, as Brian and Jeff both stated, it's very disruptive to the staff member. It does make them very, very ill. And they not only do they miss work, they miss time from their families. I would akin it to something like chemotherapy. I mean, if you know people that take chemo, it really knocks you down and knocks you down bad. The other thing I want you to consider in this body fluid exposure is we've all talked about inmates that have an altercation with staff. We also have inmates that have body fluid exposures on purpose. These inmates will prep their body fluids to douse the staff with them, whether it be inside their cell to keep the staff from coming inside their cell, or as a retaliation to something that they perceive the staff have done. And while we hold those inmates accountable for their actions in doing that, this is a weapon that they use, and it's not just a weapon to physically assault the staff, but it's also a mental weapon they use against the staff, because then the inmates refuse to allow the staff to know whether they have a communicable disease or not. A little bit about the process that Brian was talking about. We did have a body fluid exposure last night at EOCI, which is an institution that I represent. And I'm currently waiting back, as we speak right now, to hear back from the superintendent of that institution whether those inmates have given authorization for their medical records to be released. So this transpired last night between 10 and 11 o'clock, and it's over 12 hours, and we still don't have this information. Should those inmates decide they don't want to release that, because as it stands right now, it's their decision, then I have to get with our legal attorney through ASME and have her file a brief through the courts to mandate that be released. And that will take however long it takes for the judge to hear the case. So it can delay this process 24 to 36 hours very easily, that our staff are unsure of whether they have a disease or not. In lieu of that, they have to start this expensive cocktail. So we're asking for your support in this bill so that can change, and that the medical professionals can do what medical professionals do, and that's have a very frank conversation and know what it is they need to treat.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two things. First of all, Senator Knopp kindly looked up the bill. I don't think the relating clause on this one's going to work, but here I will use a priority bill to deal with the county corrections piece of it, which I appreciate. Thank you, Senator, for working with me on that. I do want to say this. Obviously, I'm incredibly supportive of this bill and incredibly supportive of the work that all of you do. I think it's important to get on the record that, yes, you have to be very careful about prophylaxis when you think somebody's been exposed in a substantial way. But these diseases are not as communicable as people once feared. We do have to be very careful, and it's very appropriate to be super careful, especially with our public safety officers, whether they're corrections or on the front lines, out in the streets. But I don't want the audience or anybody listening at home to think that these diseases can be transmitted as easily as a cold, or that there's that level of risk in that short a period of time. I think it's very important to be very careful. I think this bill is really important. I'm obviously supportive. But I just want to make sure from a medical professional perspective that I clarify on the record that the risk is real, but it's not astronomically high. So I just wanted to clarify that for the record. Thank you for your understanding of that.
Okay. One thing I wanted to bring up, that the people we deal with in our settings are at much risk for the activities they've done. Our rates, according to the Department of Corrections, 1 in 3 has hep C, 1 in 200 is HIV, just above the normal average.
Oh, I'm not, excuse me, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I'm not disagreeing about their rates. I'm just clarifying what the risk of transmission is to you and your brother and sister officers, which I agree, your rates are much higher than the general population, although in our age group, and I'm part of it, our risk for hep C is actually much higher than most people realize, and everybody should get tested. But I just wanted to clarify about the transmission risk to corrections officers being a little bit lower than perhaps some people might have thought listening to this. I'm not criticizing you at all. Yeah. I'm just clarifying on the record.
Right.
Thank you.
Chairman Anderson, if I might. Senator Hayward, I agree with you. The transmission piece isn't there. The thing is because the corrections officer and the people who are on the front lines dealing with this, because a lot of times if they're breaking up fights or they're doing something, there's usually sometimes wounds in their arms or in their hands or their knuckles or their face or whatever. And I understand. It's not as normal as you think. Bloodborne pathogens, when we go through the we understand that. And I understand the public may not, well, they're sitting back here. But the chances, because of the population we deal with, are a lot higher than the people that are in the general public. And
I'm not disagreeing
I know you
with
do.
You at all.
And I appreciate you bringing that up, because it's important that they understand it as well.
Right.
So I appreciate your outlook on it, and thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Other discussion? Thank you, gentlemen, so much for coming. And I'd like to call up Michael Gower.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Senator Cruz, and committee members, my name is Michael Gower. I'm the Assistant Director for Operations for the Department of Corrections, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 367. You've heard from my brother officers back here. We do run one of the safest, I believe, correctional departments in the nation, and if we have one of these type of activities, assault or where they actually are throwing a projectile, it's one too many. I didn't have the opportunity to actually grow up in the system. I've only been with DOC for 14 years, but I started my career in 1983 as a police officer, 10 years in Massachusetts and 10 years out here with the state police. And I take kind words to your Senator Steinward with you incorporating the frontline police officers, because that's where my exposure. So I have experienced this firsthand in my police world, not in my corrections world. And I know exactly how traumatic that can be, not only for the individual involved, but also for the family members. This bill streamlines the process for our staff to receive what we believe quicker information to make critical decisions on their health care, which we know obviously would be beneficial for wellness. And wellness is one of our top initiatives for our agents. So we would like to see this be approved, and we appreciate the support. I can answer any questions if you
like. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you for your time.
B.J. Kavanaugh.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is B.J. Kavanaugh. I am Executive Director of 1 in 4 Chronic Health. I want to be perfectly clear that I'm not speaking on behalf of any HIV service organization at all. I do not know if they've weighed in on this. We have not had a chance to communicate regarding this. I'm here to oppose but ask questions about the bill. Frankly, I've yet to see the science in this as to why this is necessary. Senator Steiner Hayward will probably support me in this, or I hope, in saying that the rate of exposure, post-exposure prophylaxis, or what we call PEP, is extremely rare. In fact, the Centers for Disease Control puts it at 0.3%, and that includes all incidences, including hospital transmissions, which are needle sticks, which have the highest risk because you're taking the actual bloodborne pathogen and injecting it into the body. There is very little or no clinical evidence to suggest that the amount of HIV that would be found in bodily fluids, blood, urine, feces, etc., is of a higher enough virus level to transmit HIV. I have great respect and admiration for all of our law enforcement officers, including our first responders and the gentlemen who were here representing their brother and sister officers today. The problem I have is I question whether or not, because we have these universal precautions which have been standard and are in place and are overseen not only by OSHA, our federal partner in this, but also by the state, whether or not these are worth essentially removing a civil right from certain patients. Specially protected health information is specially protected health information for a reason. And I agree that you should seek the necessary recourse and people should begin treatment immediately after exposure. But I just really have to question why this is going forth. I mean, yes, HIV medications are Not the most pleasant thing, I know. I've been on them for 20-plus years, and I wouldn't want anyone to have to take them unless they absolutely had to. But we have procedures in place. We have rules in place. We have laws in place, not to mention which no one has spoken of, but the provisions around access to mental health information, including psychiatrist notes, in this, which is another provision of specially protected health information, is extremely concerning. So I guess my question is, why is this bill being considered when such a very minute portion of people are at risk for this, and we already have exhaustive procedures in place to manage the situation? And by the way, let me also correct something. Right now, if any one of you was to receive accidental exposure to a substance, you would be tested. Your blood would be tested immediately. You'd be put on treatment for whatever it is thought that treatment would be. And then we would be able to, within 72 hours, have an idea of what your blood looked like based on a polymerase chain reaction, PCR, testing that would show the amount of virus in your body present or not. And in fact, in many cases, we could see whether or not there's virus present in your body within 24 hours. So the technology has gotten so to the point that this is not what it was a decade or even 15 years ago. This is not where the outcomes were so incredibly low. This is a point now where we have post-exposure prophylaxis that is incredibly effective. And I don't know the percentage, but I know it's incredibly effective to the point that even, you know, this shouldn't be a consideration. And I might also add that if these inmates were receiving the treatment that they require for these conditions, the amount of virus in their system of any one of these diseases would not be transmittable. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Protocol is such that they are to be given a cocktail, which is extremely... the side effects can be extreme, and so this is between medical providers, and so to be able to prevent that cocktail from being given, even though maybe 50% would still have to receive it, it's in the best interest, I think, of the employee at this point in time.
Madam Chair, I agree that people should be able to and have the ability to seek all medical recourse in the event of such a situation. My question is whether or not, setting aside the rights that we have as citizens in the state, is warranted by something that you have a 99.7% chance of not being exposed to.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Kavner, you and I have had a lot of conversations about a lot of different things, and we have a constructive working relationship. But I would say a couple of things with regard to your concerns. The first is that one of the differences, I think, between our public safety officers and those of us who live in the rest of the world is that we live with probability and they live with possibility. Right? And that's an important distinction that I think we need to make when we think about the actions or the protocols that we use with our public safety officers, whether they're in corrections or on the front lines. And so I agree the probability is low, but the possibility is real.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that universal precautions don't help very much when you're involved in an altercation. I know that transmission of HIV in particular is limited even in the case of puncture wounds, puncture injections with a hollow core needle, but it's there. And I think that while I certainly believe that many people in our correction systems are working hard to improve their lives and change their behaviors and move in the right direction, that to some extent, they've made decisions in their life that have led to them having some of their rights abrogated by societal decision. Now, that doesn't mean that we should be profligate about their personal information by any means, and you know that I'm very careful about that.
I do.
Conversely, I would argue that one of the reasons we've changed HIV testing from opt-in to opt-out is to destigmatize it, right? And that the point is that these are not These should not be considered special any more than diabetes or hypertension are considered special in this day and age. They're treatable chronic illnesses and should be treated as such, just like anything else. So do I think that they may be offering post-exposure prophylaxis a little too liberally? Perhaps. And I think that's a conversation that's worth having, and I would encourage the union representatives to have that conversation about the protocols with the Department of Corrections and the physicians who are caring for these officers. But do I think that our corrections officers and our public safety officers deserve an extra layer of protection for putting themselves in harm's way to protect the rest of us? I think there's a pretty good case to be made for yes in this one. So is the probability high? No. Is the possibility real? Yes. There's some unique features to this situation where OSHA can't protect you. So I get what you're saying, but taking from a both public safety perspective and a medical perspective, I'm not convinced that I agree with you.
Madam Chair, Senator Spencer Hayward, I understand what you're saying, and of course I agree with the principle of this. The concern that I have is that I don't feel as if this bill actually reflects the steps that we as a whole are trying to take to destigmatize these conditions, and that seemed to be representative in some of the comments, not intentional in any way, but the spirit of some of the comments that some of the gentlemen who had presented earlier had said. And there is, I believe, not only fear and perhaps misinformation around this. My concern is that how is this information then used between corrections officers and their staff? If this is indeed health, especially protected health information, then do they disclose it to a working partner? If they're taking medication for something, then that should be between them and their doctor and perhaps any representative to their union that they have. You can't put cancer back in the bag. And that's one of the concerns that I have. We're talking about emotion. We're talking about statistics. We're talking about science here. And I'm concerned that this might not be the right way to do it. That being said, I would be in favor of something that offered the same level of protections for all first responders, including those such as paramedics and fire service people who are at an equally great risk to exposure in their daily work.
Further discussion? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will talk among the committee on where we will go from here, and I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 367 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 368. Senator Hansel or Oliver, do you want to?
Sure.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 368, it would create a new definition for individuals that are in the custody of a local juvenile justice system. The bill would require commercial insurance carriers to reimburse a local municipality for the cost of medical services provided to a juvenile residing in a detention facility. There is no fiscal revenue statements. Testimonies on all this.
Thank you, Chair Melissa Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator for District 29, North Central and Eastern Oregon. Last July, I received an email from Dale Primmer, the director of the Umatilla County Community Justice Program, and Umatilla County Commissioner Bill Elfring regarding an issue in Umatilla County. In June of 2015, a juvenile was involved in a shooting. The youth was a shooter and was himself shot in the arm. The bullet did significant damage to his arm, which advanced to the point where extensive medical procedures were needed. The juvenile had been remanded into custody by the court, and as such, his insurance was discontinued once placed in detention. In 2014 session, we passed House Bill 4110 at the request of Claudia Black and Multnomah County. House Bill 4110 stated that an insured individual who is in the custody of a local supervisory authority is allowed to keep their insurance as long as they paid for their premiums. That bill required the insurer to reimburse the county for covered services. That bill, however, was only for individuals over the age of 18. Because of this, youths who are in correction systems in counties where jails are located are the responsibility of the county for all medical costs until they turn 18 years old. In the case of the juvenile I referenced, that was 5 months. But it could be years if juveniles are placed in corrections at an earlier age. As mentioned before, HB 4140, we allowed insurance policies to continue when their client was pre-trial incarcerated. To that intent, Senate Bill 368 does the same for pre-trial incarcerated juveniles. Commissioner Elfrin has traveled from Umatilla County and is here today to testify on why the bill could be helpful to all our county partners in the juvenile justice system. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
I do remember it took us a couple of sessions to get that last bill through. I worked on it, as I'm sure other members of this committee did, too. I would like to, are there questions for Senator Hansel? Okay, with that, I'll call up Stacy Michelson, Bill Elfrin, and Elizabeth Remley. And we'll have Bill Elfrin and then Stacy Michelson and then Elizabeth Remley.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to speak today regarding this issue. My name is Bill Elfrin. I live in Hermiston, Oregon. I'm a Umatilla County Commissioner. I have liaison responsibility with the law enforcement continuum in Umatilla County. That begins with the arresting officer at the sheriff's office, follows through the district attorney who prosecutes the case, and subsequently for post-conviction community corrections, which our department manager, Dale Primer, brought this issue up to us again. I retired from my business 12 years ago. My business was for 43 years in company management and agency operations for an insurance company, major insurance company. I managed my own insurance agency for the last 20 years of that career. In 2014, I was very supportive of the bill that came out of this body to remove policy language that excluded otherwise eligible adults incarcerated awaiting trial, individuals charged but not convicted, innocent until proven guilty. These were individuals who had purchased their policies in good faith, paid their insurance premiums faithfully, then, whether right or wrong, were charged with a crime and incarcerated awaiting trial. And subsequently, while ill or injured in jail, they were denied medical coverage and medical benefits. Benefits for which they had already paid the premiums, kept their policies in force. But now when they needed the coverage, they were denied benefits simply because they were in jail. No other reason. They were awaiting trial, still innocent until proven guilty. Insurance company responsibility to pay for medical treatment fell then to the facility to pay for. In Umatilla County, the organization that maintains the jail is Umatilla County. So those costs then transferred to us, the insurance company's responsibility to pay. And I might add, to my knowledge, no refunds of premium during that time while they were in jail. And I really don't think that the insurance companies intentionally intended for this exclusion to apply to people who were still innocent. I believe they intended it to apply to people who were convicted, who were permanent residents for a period of time in that jail facility. Fortunately, that bill passed into law and is now part of our statutes. However, it wasn't quite complete. I'm not sure how this occurred, but for some reason, juveniles were left out of that equation. It wasn't addressed. And now this is what appears to me to be housekeeping to bring this back in so that the juveniles are protected as well as adults in the same circumstance. Your own staff summary indicates that in 2008, presumably the last date that statistics are available for, some 2,110,000 people under age 18 were arrested. Not convicted, arrested. Of those 2,110,000 people, 81,000 were convicted. So it whittles down pretty quickly down to those who are convicted. A large number of people charged, very few convicted. Why? Because either several different cases that could have led to that. The district attorney could have seen the case, reviewed the case, and determined there was nothing to charge. Could have gone to a grand jury, and a grand jury determined that there's no true bill, not enough facts to support it. Or it could have gone on to trial, and a trial judge or a jury may have deemed that the person was not guilty of the crime. Anyway, innocent until proven guilty. So 2,029,000 young people were without health insurance and no premium credits for that period of time. It's just not right, and it's just not just. It needs to be fixed. Coverage is paid for and should be provided for any illness or injury that occurs while awaiting trial. Likewise, it is not right or just that this become the responsibility of the taxpayers. A premium was paid for coverage. The coverage should be provided. How many juveniles might have had health insurance if that were the case? No statistics, no way of really knowing. Juveniles are for the most part covered under their parents' policy as an extension of that policy. So there's no way to know how big an impact this really has. I know that it could have impacted us just recently to the tune of an $1,800 bill. That's significant, especially when the county struggles to put a budget together that doesn't want to come together really very, very quickly. But it's just an injustice that needs to be corrected. Senate Bill 368 merely extends the same consideration to juveniles as it currently does to adults by prohibiting any exclusion while incarcerated awaiting adjudication. I urge you to pass it. I thank you for your time, and I'll answer any questions that I might.
Let's go with Stacy.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stacy Michelson. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties. I'll keep this brief because I don't have a lot to add that Commissioner Elfrain didn't already say, and I thank him for bringing this issue forward. I will echo that. You know, our counties face a lot of budgetary issues, particularly our smaller, more rural counties. And these costs do have a big impact on our local justice systems. You know, we've seen a big return on investment after the bill previously passed around adults. And I think, you know, it's a huge portion to do this for juveniles as well. We know that at least in the adult population, many folks who become justice involved often have mental health issues or other, health issues that it's important to address very early on. Some of these folks at our younger age may be struggling with some of those issues as well. So it's really important, I think, that we're able to adequately capture the health needs of those populations. And for reasons even as basic as continuity of care, having that paid for by their primary insurance company is really huge and would go a big step forward, not only for alleviating some of the burden on our local governments, but also just from the health perspective of those individuals. So I stand with Commissioner Elfrain on this one, and AOC would urge your support of this bill.
Thank you. And I do remember why the bill was brought forward. Last time we had a county, and I don't remember which one, who had an inmate or patient, I should say, that needed transfusions twice a week, and it was bankrupting their small system, their county. So,
what in the same county?
Oh, your county?
Yes,
oh.
Senator. It was. Okay. It was dialysis.
Oh, dialysis.
And
okay.
Very, very expensive, and took a long time, continuous coverage, and it was very expensive for the county.
All right. Thank you. Let's go with Elizabeth, and then open it up for questions.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here representing Cambia Health Solutions, which is the parent company for Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. We have neither support nor opposition for this bill, but we do have one technical request, and I need to chat with Senator Hansel and ask the committee for an amendment. The implementation date on this bill is incredibly important. We need it to be January 1. This is a common refrain around insurance issues because our plan dates are January 1 and we have to file so far in advance. We would like to make sure that that's reflected. So that's all that I have to say.
Right now it's 91st day after signee dies. So
yeah.
Madam Chair.
To you. Yes.
Ms. Remley. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but how many cases do we think there really are?
I don't know that. Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Harwood, I don't know the answer, and I also don't, what I also don't know at the current time, and I need to get an answer for you, is how this necessarily affects rate filing. It's a question that I have, too, and I just need to get an answer for it.
If I may, Madam Chair, I appreciate your concern, and I think if we were talking about something that was likely to have a broad-based impact, I would completely agree with you that it's important to go with the plan years. In this particular case, I mean, all of, I don't know how many youth are arrested in Oregon. That number you were giving wasn't just
that
Oregon.
That was nationwide.
That was nationwide. So the number in Oregon has to be markedly smaller, and most of those are not detained in pretrial, for pretrial. And even the ones who are, the number who have significant health issues are probably pretty darn small, and then the number of those that are insured by any one company are probably even smaller if those kids aren't already on OHP. So I appreciate your concern, and the vast majority of the time I agree with you. In this case, not so sure. Just, I think we need, feel like we need an amendment, I kind of want to get a clearer sense that you think this is likely to really have a significant impact on your reserves.
Yeah, as far as rate filings, you know, I just don't know if it would make that big of a difference at this point. Any other comments? Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I'm kind of surprised by the comment a little bit. It strikes me that these are kids, obviously, that are covered by an insurance program, whether it's the public one or the private. If they had a health issue and weren't incarcerated, there would be no question that they would be covered by the insurance provider. So the fact that they're in custody, the only issue is who delivers the health care, not whether they should be covered or not, because they've already, somebody has obviously already paid the premium. And I'm not sure that the delay would really make a lot of sense, or difference, I should say. I don't know about sense. I'm not sure you would, your Regents would have that. If they were a Regents customer, they'd be a Regents customer.
Okay. Any other discussion? Thank you, panel, so very much, and I'm
very
sure
much.
We will talk with the committee, and we will let Senator Hansel know what we're going to do. With that, I will close the public hearing on close the public